You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on June 22nd and 23rd, 2015, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, guest Deanna joins me to discuss the Charleston shooting. Then, Nate joins me to talk about the Women's World Cup and women's athletics around the world. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. It's Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Returning to the show now is our columnist from arsenalfordemocracy.com on the line from Southern California, Deanna. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk this week about the shooting in Charleston that happened at the end of last week. This has obviously been on the minds of a lot of folks. My first reaction, actually, though, was, I don't know about you, but was kind of like, this is literally so similar to just so many other incidents, not just in recent years, but in the grand arc of American history, that it was almost like, what else is left to say? And after I thought about it some more, it seemed like what did kind of confirm was a lot of the stuff that had been, you know, individually said about a lot of the incidents in the past several months or so, or in the past year, particularly since Ferguson, the things that were said about that, like all crystallized into one tragic incident that was very predictable, and sort of the like what happened in the incident and also how the media reacted to it. It just seemed like it was combining every possible like bad thing that had been mishandled in the last, you know, year into one just giant mess. And I mean, to the point where a lot of people had noticed that the media is actually more willing to talk about gun control than almost any big shooting incident, because they'd rather talk about gun control, which is a taboo, than talk about race in America. I don't know what your thoughts were on any of that.
Actually, I think you're really correct. It does feel like it's just an amalgamation of everything. All the criticisms that have been happening since Ferguson, if you look at the situation, it's a giant red flag. Like, people talked about how you have incidents like Ferguson and you have incidents like before in South Carolina with the officer that shot the man on camera and then tried to plant evidence on him. The way that Dylan Roof is being treated compared to several instances of Black people's encounters with the police has been drastically different. Like, if you look at Mike Brown was killed, that the other man in South Carolina was killed. You saw the McKinney incident where the 14-year-old girl was slammed to the ground by a police officer. But when Dylan Roof is apprehended, they put a bulletproof vest on him and they go and buy him a burger.
They didn't even give him handcuffs, I think.
No, if you look at the pictures of when they first take him out of where he was, I don't believe he was at home, but where he was held up at.
Yeah, North Carolina.
It looks like he just has his hands behind his back. It almost looks like he has handcuffs on, but then as he gets up to the cop car, his hands are free. He's just walking to the cop car like it's just a stroll to the park. It's very, very drastic and frightening how much care they treated him compared to all the numerous people of color, not just Black people, but other people of color that have been just abused by the police in the past year since Ferguson.
I don't know. That's why I keep saying it's almost like what are we even supposed to talk about anymore with this? Because it's the exact same thing that we've been talking about with everything. I mean, you know, even just church bombings, like obviously Fox News is trying to make this into like it's an attack on Christians or something, which is kind of off topic and in their own way of derailing things and fitting things into their narrative. But like, even attacks on churches, specifically Black churches, are not only you know, not unprecedented, but it's not even something that it was just limited to, like, you know, the 1960s and 50s and the time before then, which is now ancient history. No, I mean, Mother Jones compiled a list of just the attacks on black churches since, like, 96, and I think it's at least a dozen. I mean, you know, they're not necessarily mass shootings like this, but, you know, arson attacks and bombings and other things like that. I mean, this is, you know, there's that. There's the whole trying to say that the shooter must be mentally ill so we can just forget about this because, you know, we don't have to worry about his ideology or we don't have to worry about anything systemic or anything like that. You know, just write it off, say that he must have been psychotic or something, even though he probably wasn't. Which has also been the case with a lot of these other shootings. But this one in particular really reinforces it because we know what his, you know, political ideology, so to speak, was and that he had one. It wasn't that he was just going in to shoot a bunch of people. It was for a very specific reason. And then the gun control debate. I mean, literally all these things, they've been coming up and coming up and coming up. It's like, what is left to say? Because it is just the perfect encapsulation of all of them.
Well, like you said, I think it's the fact that that the U.S. does not want to talk about race, period. Like, they would rather it be about gun control issues. They would rather it be an attack on Christianity. But actually looking at the fact that, no, these people were attacked because they were black. And even just the site that he attacked, like, I don't know if he had specifically targeted that church because of that church's history, but the fact that that church has the specific history with the civil rights movement and things like that, and people are still trying to ignore it. They're trying to be like, well, you know, it's sad that the black church got shot up, but, you know, we should worry about gun control. And it's like, okay, well, gun control, yeah, we need gun control, but also we need to stop fostering this attitude that he's mentally ill and he's kind of an outskirt and he's, you know, trying, it's always, the narrative is always, oh, well, that individual was crazy when some white kid shoots up a movie theater or shoots up a school or shoots up a black church. It's never, hey, what systems do we have in place that make these people so fragile that the slightest thing, because people are saying that the reason that he was so angry at black people was because the girl he liked started dating a black guy. That's how is it that the U.S. has developed such a society that something that small can make him snap like that? It's not just an individual thing. It happens too often for it to just be, oh, these people are crazy. There's something wrong with the system, but America doesn't want to talk about it. And that's a huge part of the problem.
Right. And our other friend of the show, past co-host and past guest contributor and everything, Greg, wrote a long piece about all the conspiracy theories that immediately emerged to try to, like, discredit this in some way, you know, or either to ascribe it to dark, nefarious forces beyond our recognition, or to just say, well, you know, it couldn't have been him, or maybe he was being manipulated or something like that. I mean, the guy wrote, you know, a 2,000-word quote-unquote manifesto with various citations explaining his entire, like, worldview, and much more coherently than a lot of these, you know, shooters have. And yet people are saying, well, no, that maybe it's not really his, or maybe he didn't really write it, or, you know, various things like that. And it's like, okay, but as Greg said, even if you accepted all of the huge leaps required to discredit all of that information, at the end of it, you still get that this guy, fitting into an archetypal pattern, you know, walks in and shoots 9 people in a specifically black church, a famously black church, that, you know, has all these flags, you know, Confederate flags and Rhodesian flags and all this other stuff, on, you know, in his actual photographs, and was openly telling friends and acquaintances about all his various, you know, racial views and racial supremacy views. You know, it gets into all kinds of issues of, you know, also like white poverty in America and issues of manhood and lack of opportunities there. I mean, I'm not trying to, like, you know, explain away his behavior, but like you said, it is part of a bigger pattern and set of systems here, that this didn't just suddenly come out of nowhere. It came through this, like, huge organic buildup. And I think it's so strange, not surprising, but strange, the contrast of how we talk about him and regard him versus, you know, so many black people, black individuals, right? Instead of being treated as individuals, you know, they get the blanket treatment of, well, they came from a system and that, you know, produced this, you know, they were in a violent environment or something, like all kinds of claims, which aren't necessarily even backed up. But we don't talk about any of that with this guy, because it's much easier to just say that he's this one strange outlier individual rather than, you know, part of some bigger systemic problem. And as Greg had also pointed out, right, like, and I think you were saying this too, the people who get the heightened scrutiny are the black victims, not even the folks, you know, going out and killing people. I think there was this past weekend, a young man in Chicago died, like jumping in front of a gun to save his mom. And the, you know, one newspaper framed it that way in the headline, and the other newspaper said, you know, troubled man with criminal past, you know, killed in gunfire, saved mom. You know, like as an afterthought, right? That it's that there's this overwhelmingly negative treatment, you know, immediate rush to judgment of the victims when it's the black victims, but then wanting to just completely write off and forget about, you know, the one guy that does this openly white supremacist shooting. You know, I don't know. Like I said, it's not surprising, but it's definitely worth noting and discussing.
And also what I think is worth noting is the fact that the excuses don't change when it comes to stuff like this, when it comes to white supremacists and white supremacist killings and all of these things like that. Like, if you look at his manifesto, this is something that has been, a lot of the stuff that he was saying was stuff that had been said in like the 60s or the 1860s about like black people being dangerous, specifically. There's this trope of black men being dangerous to black women, and black men will come and rape our women and things like that. And it's the how is it that the narrative is still exactly the same after 100 and something years?
Right.
Obviously, this is something that needs to be talked about. But for some reason, when things like this happen, it's stuck at that point. It's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things that's come out of this is how not fringe some of the stuff that influenced him was. I mean, you know, some of the actual talking points were fairly mainstream conservative talking points and, you know, Fox News type talking points. They weren't outliers at all. But, you know, the group that he specifically cited was something like the Council of Conservative Citizens or something like that. It was the CFCC was the abbreviation. And he was quoting very extensively from their website. And, you know, in typical fashion of any of these, you know, hate websites, which it essentially is, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center has classified it as a hate group. The leader denied, you know, said, well, it's not surprising that he quoted us because we accurately and honestly report the situation, the racial situation in America these days, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center will tell you this is completely standard operating procedure. It has been since the dawn of the internet because, you know, as I recently remarked, since the World Wide Web started, two things immediately popped up, pornography and hate groups, and they have remained very powerful forces, you know, in certain sections of the internet ever since. And in these hate groups, they will consistently, you know, put out this violent racial ideology, and then when somebody acts upon it and cites them, they say, well, we don't have anything to do with that. We didn't actually tell anyone to go out and commit these crimes. We didn't have any hand in it. We didn't know it was going to happen. So they feign ignorance, right? So they've been doing that every time. But the thing about this particular group is that they are not even like a, you know, neo-Nazi type, openly, completely, obviously super right-wing white nationalist group. In fact, the founder of the group has been a major Republican donor to lots and lots of candidates. Now, this wasn't getting a lot of traction in the United States, but The Guardian, which is a UK paper that's been doing really good work on race in America since Ferguson, especially, I mean, they've been going all over the country reporting on all kinds of stories that aren't getting as much attention in the US media. They came up with a list of all of the Republican candidates they could find at any level of government, you know, local, county, state, U.S. Senate, U.S. House, even presidential candidates. And they compiled a list of all the people that the founder of this group had donated money to. And it's a very long list. I mean, even Mitt Romney, who's, you know, a Northeast Republican, not hurting for money when he was running for his campaigns and was, you know, out in front on the issue of the Confederate flag in the past several days. Right. Even he had taken money from this guy. And at some level, it was clear that the level of prevalence here was such that they just weren't doing any due diligence on who the heck this guy was. But, you know, you've now got Rick Santorum, Ted Cruz, Scott Walker, all having to donate money to charity because they had taken money from this guy that's being openly cited, you know, by this white supremacist mass shooter. And various other sitting Republican senators, I know Jeff Flake from Arizona also had to give back money. And you could just write it off and say, oh, well, it's some bizarre outlier. Maybe they didn't check into this. But if we look back just a few months ago, Steve Scalise, who is now the majority whip, he's in the official Republican House leadership now in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's a congressman from Louisiana. And a few months ago, we learned that he had given a speech at a like KKK event. Basically, I forget there was some, you know, Euro-American unity or some, you know, facade type name for it, but it was essentially a Louisiana KKK type of thing. And he's literally still there. They just said, well, he was really sorry. And it was a long time ago. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. I think it was like, you know, early 2000s or something. So this is, you know, there's this myth that we're, you know, so far removed from the civil rights movement, right? That's finished history or whatever. And in fact, it's continuing to present day that there hasn't been almost any change at all. We've still got these guys who are in very powerful offices, who are basically openly tied to these neo-Confederate groups, neo-Nazi groups, that kind of thing, and don't seem to really care unless they get caught. And even then, there aren't necessarily consequences. The biggest consequence we've actually seen in the past year was that the Nevada state House speaker who was initially nominated turned out he was a neo-Confederate who thought that the, you know, it was a real bummer how the Civil War turned out, even though Nevada was a very prominent, you know, pro-union state that has in its constitution all kinds of anti-secessionist provisions. And he had to end up not becoming the House Speaker. I don't think he had to resign from office, but he didn't get to be the state House Speaker there. I mean, that's the only person that's faced any consequences. So that's sort of, you know, I think something that really needs to be looked at. And so far, it's been almost dead silence from the media on this.
That is actually very, very scary. But I saw in the news today that a bunch of politicians were actually having to give money back or donate to charity because it was found out that they were all receiving money from these white supremacy groups. But again, it's very, very strange for me because for me, it's like, it's sad that it's happening. But at the same time, I feel like I'm not shocked. And that's so, it's not funny, but I'm not shocked by it. Like the way that right wing Republican parties work, it makes sense, even though it shouldn't. And that's, I'm sitting here and I'm stuttering and I'm I sound really, really dejected, but it's very, very hard to, as a black person, talk about these things because it's like you want to do all of this work and you want to think that there's been so much change and you want to think that things have gotten better, but then you have things like this happen and it's kind of, it takes the wind out of you every single time.
Do you think that there's progress being made on the front with the Confederate flag? I mean, that to me seems like a relatively superficial thing, but I also definitely support the effort to get it taken down. And you know, today, earlier today, as we're recording this on Monday, June 22nd, we had the governor of South Carolina, and I also believe Lindsey Graham, the senior senator from South Carolina, both coming out and saying that they thought that it should be taken down from the Capitol. You know, is that something that you see progress on? Is that even something to get at all optimistic about, or is it just seriously too minor of a thing that should have happened a long time ago as well?
I do think it's a thing that should have happened a long time ago, obviously, but unfortunately it hasn't. I won't say that it's not something to get behind because it is, it's a, like the Confederate flag is a terrible symbol of anything going on in America for multiple layers of reasons. One of those reasons being racism. The other one of those reasons being it's, I don't understand how you can be a proud American, but then also want to stand behind a flag that was trying to break apart America. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Right.
So, but I do think it's, I think it's something that needs to be taken down. And it's something that needs to be, it's something that needs to be taken down because at the, it means that you're make, people are making an effort. Now, all of these politicians coming out and saying that they want it taken down after this sort of incident seems a little sketchy. Like, I want to believe that these people really do finally see that this is a symbol of oppression and that it's extremely offensive. But at the same time, I worry that people are being opportunistic. And I worry that people are going to use this as, well, we took the flag down. What more you want?
Yeah, I think that last point is going to be critical, that they're going to once again try to say that this is a huge victory that we took this down and therefore all problems are solved and racism in America is over. I mean, at this point, the Confederate flag, I think, you know, some people are worried that this is going to become some kind of a distraction, the focus on the flag itself. I think there's a number of reasons why this is becoming a focus. For one thing, it seems like a relatively doable thing in an era that even outside of the context of race, nothing seems to get done one way or the other. So if this can be solved, you know, on a policy level, even though if it's a tiny victory, it's maybe our only victory. I mean, we're not going to solve racism, right? And we're not going to, you know, solve any number of other problems. We're definitely not going to do gun control. That's just not going to happen. So this seems like something that people feel like they can get behind because it might actually make a difference. And then they can, you know, have some more restored confidence in the system, but it's going to definitely need to go beyond that. You know, other positive signs of pressure, Walmart, the giant global retail chain based in Arkansas, said that they're no longer going to sell the Confederate flag or products with the Confederate flag on it. I think that's going to be hugely influential as well, particularly on the sort of private sector side, so to speak. You know, but obviously, this, like I said, this flag has moved well beyond just its secessionist roots and quote unquote heritage, because there are a lot of Germans in Germany who seem to have a very strong affinity for the heritage, in air quotes, of the South, because Germany has much stricter laws regarding hate crimes and hate speech. And you know, they've banned all the, you know, Nazi-related symbols and stuff like that, which that's something that wouldn't ever happen here. And so they use things like the Confederate flag as, like, a way of not very silently signaling to people their real tendencies. So again, yeah, I mean, this isn't going to, like, fix the problem, but it almost feels like, well, it's something that we can do, so we might as well get that done because nothing else is going to get done. And I guess that's a really pessimistic way to look at it, but I don't know how else to look at it.
Also, I think that Walmart deciding that they're not going to sell any Confederate flag paraphernalia is good because especially a lot of places in the South, Walmart is the store to go to for anything. So if all of a sudden you can't get it,
right,
it's, I don't want to say it's erasing things from everyone's head, but once you see that it's, I feel like once more and more people see that it's not okay and it's not something that is accepted, it's going to be less and less likely that people are going to, one, spout that kind of hate, but also be able to spread that to other people. Like,
yeah,
like you said, like a lot of people, like a lot of neo-Nazis in Germany are using the flag in order to signal to other people that, hey, we still have these beliefs. We can't use the one we were using before, but we can use this one. And it's like, once you take that away, it becomes harder and harder for them to communicate that and share that hate, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope so. I think, unfortunately, the internet has made it so that it's very easy to get connected with people that you, you know, agree with, which has its positive sides, and in this case, its very negative sides. But I do, you know, I think you make an interesting point, though, in terms of, like, just kind of getting it out of the, you know, the omnipresence stage, where it's just everywhere, and you can just buy it, like, it's no thing, because obviously, this is a symbol of hate, and it's terrible, and it should be restricted to basically museums and maybe Civil War reenactments, except that even some of those are pretty weird in the South. I think that there are genuinely people, especially younger people in the South, who maybe haven't given it a lot of thought, and, you know, they do see it everywhere, and so it becomes, you know, like an iconic symbol of the South and just kind of stands in as shorthand for the South and a Southern identity. And even though it is a symbol of hate, you know, just having it around, you could conceivably grow up without having a fairly extensive discussion about the real, like, real impact of that symbol and what it means and the hate that it's been associated with, because, as we know, the United States is very uncomfortable with going over any sort of negative stuff in its history. So I'm betting there are, you know, if you go to a very white area of the South, and you could probably get K through 12 without having a serious discussion or even interaction with people who have a different perspective than you about you, you know, you would see it your whole life and not be aware. You would know that it was related to the Civil War, but you wouldn't know all the other extra layers of context or even necessarily, unfortunately, what the Civil War was about, because there's still people trying to claim constantly that it wasn't about slavery, whatever. But, you know,
yeah, that's a strange argument to me, because people want to say that it wasn't about slavery, that it was about taxes or it's about states' rights. And I'm like, well, yeah, it was about it was largely about the states' rights to own slaves. Like, that was a huge part of it. I don't understand how people don't. Right. How is that not about slavery?
Right. So I think with something like the Walmart change, like you said, that kind of gets it. It puts it front and center in the sense of forcing a discussion about this. I think this whole thing does. But I think also taking it away from Walmart means that it's no longer, you know, you're wandering through the aisles and you're like, oh, hey, cool, a Southern thing, right? Because it's just not there anymore. And I think that might sort of start to slowly diminish it. Although I was darkly joking online earlier that maybe this is going to be the key to reviving the extinct textile industry in the South. Some entrepreneur with a very strong Confederate streak, or at least an enterprising person who wants to fill a void and take advantage of that, is going to maybe start up a whole factory that just does nothing but produce Confederate stuff.
Oh my gosh, it's going to be an Etsy page, and it's going to be so scary.
I mean, this has obviously been a very hard several days.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also just nothing's been surprising about it. I mean, this kid went out, did a lot of research, found out about white supremacists around the world, did like the Carmen Sandiego of hate, and came up with this like whole motif for himself about Rhodesia and whatever, which...
That was the strangest thing for me, is because I had never seen a Rhodesian flag.
Yeah, well, it's a whole, I mean, it was, and it's an unrecognized country too, just like the Confederacy. I think that probably also drew him to it. You know, something like the apartheid South Africa, that was a recognized country and flag and everything, but the Republic of Rhodesia declared independence unilaterally without authority from the British Empire and everything. And so they were basically their own breakaway state, and for very similar reasons, right? They had a black majority and a white government, and the white government was not interested in having a black government. Anyway, so this guy clearly, you know, did a lot of research, came up with this like grand theory or whatever, and then this incident set him off, but he was probably just looking for an incident. But we're not really talking about it in a responsible way. It's just a very superficial way of like trying to come up with excuses that make us feel better. It's basically just been, as we said, a repeat of everything else that's been happening with all of these other incidents in the past year and many years previously as well. This is just, it's not a random act. It's not an inexplicable act. It's totally within this huge context that the media just does not want to talk about at all.
At all. Not in the least bit.
All right. Well, Deanna, thank you so much for joining me this week to talk about this issue.
No, thank you for having me.
It's Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me now in studio is Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
So we're going to talk about a topic that you have a lot more expertise on than I do, which is the Women's World Cup and women's soccer in general. I have not really been watching any of the ongoing Women's World Cup in soccer, but that's not because they're women. It's because I pretty much never watch soccer. And I know that at some point, folks like you are going to probably recruit me eventually. But for the moment, It's not, still not my thing. But you're going to talk a little bit about the sport in general and some of the sort of structural factors there.
Yeah, well, the thing about soccer that makes it sort of difficult to get into, I think, is that there are just so many teams and so many players, and you have sort of have to balance like them in a your global knowledge base, like who's good, who's not. And then you have to do it all over again for women, which makes this even more tricky, you know, the Women's World Cup, because that obviously is not the type of football that gets the most exposure both here and around the world. But I think the Women's World Cup tournament and the Olympics as well are just great showcases of the sort of competitive spirit and impressive ability of some of these national teams. So, you know, a lot of people have complained, oh, it's slower and oh, they're not as technical as the men. But when it comes down to it, there's some really exciting soccer being played. And I think that's what we need to talk about and also talk about some of the larger issues surrounding this women's sport
and women's athletics in general in some cases. This year there was definitely some positive developments. For example, the FIFA soccer game now has women. That was like a big development. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of people were looking forward to. In the past though, the U.S. women's team, as I understand it, has been, you know, a pretty good team, like pretty dominant on the international stage. And you know, with only maybe a few others, I guess that's leveling out a little bit now. But what can you explain, what were some of the factors that in the past had given the U.S. such an edge on the world stage in women's soccer as compared to, say, like men's soccer?
Yeah, and like it's important to emphasize, I'm not necessarily an expert on women's soccer, just because there's a lot of things that are very unique to it that just make it a little bit different. They don't have a total understanding. But just from what I've been able to just learn at following the tournament is that, you know, because the U.S. won, obviously, 99. I remember watching that game, penalty shootout. Brandi Chastain takes her shirt off and is like Hulk going Hulk mode. And is like, yeah, we won. Everyone got pumped up. But we also won in 91, I believe, back when Mia Hamm was like a substitute or something. Like, this is back in the really early days. And I don't know too much about that tournament, but we won that one as well. And so, you know, this is, you know, very, a long time ago in, you know, just normal soccer terms. The game has changed tremendously since then. And, you know, it seems in some ways like the U.S. has been just sort of riding on its past success, its past, you know, marketable players. Example of this obviously being Abby Wambach, and who's, of course, starting amid some controversy in this tournament. She didn't play past couple year or didn't play this past season in NWSL, National Women's Soccer League, and it's been criticized by some for being out of form, various comments to the media. But without delving too much into that, it does seem like in the past couple years the rest of the world has caught up to the United States in terms of development of their female players. And this really shouldn't be all that surprising, considering that the rest of the world is already so far ahead of the United States in terms of technical development in soccer. And just to break it down for people, you know, it doesn't really matter how strong you are and how fast you can run if you can't control the ball at, you know, while you're dribbling around or while you're running. So that's what we call technical ability, just the ability to control the ball, make a pass, you know, take a good shot. And the other countries, you know, whether it's Europe, South America, because they play soccer and so ingrained in their culture, and this is the most serious athletic competition that anybody can really get involved in pretty much any other country besides the U.S. and maybe like track and field in like Jamaica or something, you know. But they start training at an extremely young age in academies. And now that it seems like the academies for women are also being ramped up in these other countries, the U.S. is now finding itself kind of at a similar place where the men are almost. Like, we still have a lot of good investment in women's soccer. You can trace that back to Title IX and all sorts of other programs that really helped us off the ground. But it's not like we can fix the problems that are also inherent in the men's game just with, you know, extra investment in the women's game. So the countries that really have it together, it seems like, are able to use pre-existing patterns and just ways of doing things that they've learned from developing young male players and just, you know, start developing young female players as well. Maybe that wasn't a priority 10, 20 years ago, but that is now becoming something that, you know, other countries are looking to do. So we know the powers that are also strong in women's football. You know, your Germany, obviously. China's been strong for a while. There have been some Nordic countries that are doing okay. But what we're seeing in this tournament is a bunch of other countries that traditionally have just been peripheral bit players. They're actually starting to do well now. And because of the expanded tournaments, there are teams in this tournament for the first time. And I believe Nigeria, they were in for the first time. So, you know, they were putting up a really good show. There have been exciting, you know, attacking elements from a bunch of teams in this tournament. And the quality of football is higher. There are people pulling off, you know, sort of fancy tricks and stuff that you might not see in past World Cups or past Women's Olympics for soccer. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of the drama that's there. You're all seeing a higher technical level of play. And it's not just the same couple super teams that are just like rolling over everyone, you know. I guess Germany beat someone 10-0. Okay, that's like a little bit of anomaly. We're not seeing that much, but we are seeing goals. We are seeing teams that are going at each other, so it's not like one team just getting completely outclassed. There have been a bunch of games that are, you know, both sides score a couple goals. And, you know, this is, I think, an important moment for women's soccer because the soccer, I think, is starting to break into the national consciousness here in the United States. With the success of the men's soccer team last summer, hopefully, if the U.S. women can go on a run, they just beat Colombia last night, and if they can make it to, I'd say, the semifinals or the finals, that'll, you know, just continue to grow momentum for soccer in the United States, I feel like.
Yeah, you mentioned the Colombia team. I saw an article, I think NBC News or something like that. They were talking about interviewing a lot of the different players and people involved with that. And that this has been really important for them because at a national level, women's athletics has just generally not been a big presence and has been sometimes actively discouraged. They said that women previously would, you know, or even young girls would get harassed a lot for even, you know, trying to practice or whatever. And all those sort of things. I mean, it's certainly not, you know, perfect in the United States how we, you know, far from it, how we regard, you know, men's athletics versus women's athletics. But you had also alluded to earlier about like the edge that Title IX helped create, which was just that, you know, even if it wasn't great or even close to perfect, the U.S. was investing a lot of money into women's athletics much earlier than a lot of other countries.
Right, and I think there had to be a mentality change, especially like somewhere in England, right? So I guess there's connotations for the game of football that exist in many places around the world that maybe don't quite exist in the U.S. or it's just viewed differently because it's sort of for a long time, it was a peripheral sport in the U.S. It was, you know, played by kids and not really taken seriously by adults or just there was little exposure to it, just the highest level of the game being able to be viewed on television. That's all changed now. You can stream pretty much any league on your computer for, you know, a small fee. And, you know, the game is being taken seriously by children in a way that I didn't take it seriously as a kid because I didn't have access to the highest level. You know, you have a World Cup that comes around every 4 years. You weren't watching Champions League every single year. And, you know, I think as they are just leading into a situation where you have other countries that are just sort of just upping the game as well, that can lead to situations where you're having more and more eyes on the women's game and just people taking it seriously, not being discouraged. Young girls have a, you know, just role models to look forward to. I mean, even like one of my cousins, who's a guy, but you know, he's very young. He has his Abby Wambach photo on his, or a poster on his wall, you know, right next to the Clint Dempsey. You know, it's showing that these can be role models, you know, in for both young boys and young girls. And
I guess there's probably not, as you were trying to, I think you were sort of saying that we don't have those preconceived notions about soccer in the way that other countries do because it was never a big thing for either side
So to like, without going fully into it, there's certain thing I guess people call like the lad culture. And it's all about like, oh, you're out with your mates, you're getting drunk, you're having fights and stuff. And this was, you know, going back to the hooligan days in the 80s and 90s, I mean, that was football. And now it's sort of like a joking banter subculture that exists within football. But there's still elements of it that, you know, just, okay, so think about, and this is just the comparison, but soccer and soccer crowds in the U.S. are a little bit different than football crowds, like American football. But imagine if soccer is the most popular sport. The people that would be going to the football matches might be going to the soccer matches too. So it's just, it's a different culture and it just, things operate in a little bit different sense. And that, and you, for example, you wouldn't necessarily see too many younger girls playing American football. It might be ridiculed if they did. Maybe in some ways, a kind of a similar parallel there. I'm just trying to explain how it might be viewed differently. But now I think, you know, this is just based off my experience, you know, listening to occasional British soccer news or just global soccer news. Now, there are women's leagues that are becoming more and more prominent, especially you have, you know, all these clubs. And you talk about a club, usually they have a basketball team, a soccer team, probably swimming, athletic, like track and field, and women's version of these games. So I don't know how many women's basketball teams there are in Europe, but I think there are now more and more women's soccer teams. The French league is apparently quite good. Paris, Lyon, there are a bunch of leagues in England. And I believe the Liverpool women won last year. I could be wrong about that. Frankfurt, I know, has a really good women's side. Like, it's kind of interesting because there are these teams that maybe aren't dominant in the men's side, but their women are just like awesome, you know? So you have like a Frankfurt doing well on that. So it seems like just the level of play has gone up. The leagues are stronger now, and that has contributed to what we're seeing in the Women's World Cup. The only problem is I have the U.S. needs to just sort of up their game as well. I mean, the league went bankrupt, I feel, maybe 5-10 years ago, and it's only just sort of gotten off its feet again. It's really small. They need more teams. But so as you're seeing, these other countries are able to just sort of piggyback on their existing structure, have a pretty fully functional league. We can't really figure out how to do that for either men's and women's soccer here in the U.S., but I think we're definitely seeing progress. So, I mean, that's just sort of what we're looking for.
Yeah, I was thinking, it was sort of an interesting point you were making about your, you know, the younger kids having role models from both sides now. I think that's definitely going to be very unusual because, like you said, you know, with something like baseball or hockey or football, it's very male dominated side, and we don't really have a comparable, you know, pairing.
Or they're playing like a different sport altogether, like a softball,
right?
Which, you know, I like softball. I was actually just at the park and someone was trying to get me to play a game of softball because there not enough people showed up. Obviously I had to come here and record, but yeah, it's a fun game, but it's not the same game in the way that soccer is with women. And you know, it's not the exact same in terms of the players and in terms of just...
Is it pretty much the same rules, though?
Some of the speed, but it's same rules. Actually, one thing that's quite different, and this is actually really significant, is that there's much less diving. Like, they just don't dive. They don't complain. They don't surround the referee and act like they're going to murder him. You know, it's just... there's chirping, there's barking back and forth, there's physical play. In fact, I think actually women's soccer has a lot of concussions just because of, like, there's less diving and they're actually going for the ball and not just falling down on the slightest contact. But that can make it more fun to watch sometimes when you're battling for the ball, or, you know, you're both running and tripping over each other and it's not like you got brushed and you just like flung yourself in the air and you're falling down. And
the dramatic fake death scenes.
Yeah, the Aryan Robin, just like, oh... Just like he got shot in midair or something.
On that note, though, can we talk a little bit about the turf situation? Mm-hmm. That's something that I'm peripherally aware of, even as someone who hasn't really been following this too closely. Like, what's the deal with that, the Women's World Cup versus the Men's World Cup? I know there was, like, a lawsuit attempted against FIFA as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, what we're seeing, I guess, is that it's playable.
This is the artificial turf for the women versus real grass.
Yeah, and it would never, and obviously it would never happen for the men's tournaments, although plenty of other crazy things would probably happen for the men's tournaments, as we've talked about. But part of your problem, I guess, runs up in Canada because of winter. It's harder to grow grass that'll last year round, and so they're for convenience. Sometimes they'll switch to field turf. Field turf is also now not quite as bad as it was back in the day. Like, I can remember playing on the old AstroTurf, where it was just, you could feel the concrete under it, and it was just like a carpet over concrete. And I remember, like, playing on it, I was like, is this real? Like, what are we even doing? And you slid on it, it would burn you, and it was awful. Still kind of does that, the burning part, but the ball bounces weird sometimes, and, like, it'll be disconcerting when there's, like, a pile of, like, a little black pellets flying out of the ground whenever you take a especially hard step or kick the ball or something. But
so this is, as you said,
like, it's playable. Like, that's, it's not, it, I mean, it obviously would never happen in a men's tournament.
Right.
And I think this is an example of the way FIFA views women. I mean, we can go back to the Sepp Blatter quote about having them wear, you know, tighter shorts, and, you know, that would perhaps demonstrate that FIFA is still very much an old men's club when it comes to these sorts of things. But at least the tournament has been taken seriously and been promoted by them and getting it on major networks. And so I think there have been some positive things from FIFA, but probably not as a result of Sepp Blatter's words or actions.
Yeah, I think it is encouraging, though, that it's getting somewhat even-handed attention in the United States. I mean, again, soccer still is, it's growing in presence and coverage and attention, but is still not anywhere near, you know, some of the really major sports. But I think it's encouraging that the attention is pretty much roughly even at this point, I think, between the men's side and the women's side.
Well, and
I mean, I couldn't honestly name a member of the men's team from the U.S. I think I could name at least three women from the current women's team.
There you go. I mean,
and like Alex Morgan is like a, you know, superstar at this point.
Yeah, well, she's on Sports Illustrated, and Hope Solo's in ESPN The Body Issue, and or at least was a couple of years ago. And like, you just have, they've become celebrities, and some of them are very attractive. So that's also going to, like, I just saw a Christian Press and a Coppertone ad because she's amazing. And so, you know, you just have these symbols that are just, they're out there. Obviously the men's soccer team, I guess sometimes you have to be like really into soccer to get into like necessarily each and every one of the prospects that are coming up, although Jermaine Jones will be in The Body Issue next time. So if you're interested in just like hulking German midfielders, you can check that out as well. And yeah, you know, there are, I think it is important for the women's national soccer team to become I wouldn't want to say cultural icon, but in a similar way to people just view these big Olympic teams and just rever them or just view them as celebrity that carries on, you know, toward the next competition. I think that's a beneficial. And one other quick point about the media coverage of the tournament. It's a positive development that women's sports are now being critiqued, I feel like, in the same way as men's sports, to the point where everyone's now calling for the manager to get fired because they're playing just long balls to Abby Wambach the whole time. And, oh, she's out of form, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, she's 35, so I wonder why. But, you know, so now we're in a situation where people are bitching about the manager in the same way they're bitching about the manager for the men's national team. It's the exact same thing. And U.S. soccer fans are really impatient and kind of annoying.
But at least they care.
They care. And it's this, they're being treated the same way. And, you know, that's the positive. That's what we're seeing, that there's actually passion for this team. So, I mean, I think that we are seeing, just as you said, a growth. Maybe it's gradual, but we're seeing both of these teams, U.S. men, U.S. women, all the MLS teams and lower league teams across the nation, people are just taking them seriously now, and they're actually starting to care and treat them like they would any other sport, any other competition, and finally get invested in it. And I don't know, that reminds me, I need to go some Breakers games and pick up a Breakers scarf. So I actually saw one the other day and I didn't get it, so that's my fault.
All right.
Well, apparently they're good this year, so I'm going to go.
Final thought here. So we don't obviously know how the tournament's going to turn out this year, but what do you think, what are you anticipating is going to be the big takeaway in general from this Women's World Cup?
If there's like a, I mean, we could go back into what I was talking about is in other countries that are now developing more their women's programs. If a country that wasn't too prominent beforehand makes it to the final four, wins it, or at least the final or something. Or we could talk about just the, you know, the tactics and whether they were sufficient for the U.S. or not, if they're able to get to the final. There's going to be storylines around the U.S. no matter what. Or we can praise, you know, whether it's the Germans or, you know, whoever ends up winning the thing for their, you know, tactical discipline and important skills and things like that. So it's the knockout rounds are really just starting. So hopefully we're going to see some good matches and they don't get boring at all. People don't play conservatively, hopefully. So I'm excited. It should be a really good tournament. There are a bunch of other tournaments going on as well, but when it's the World Cup, you know, you just got to watch. So,
all right. Well, Nate, thanks for stopping by to talk about this today.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.